Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you got it.
Red, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio! The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Praise Yahweh and pass the ammunition.
The Restoration Hour with Pastor Eli James.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here. And today I have a special guest, Michael Goodrich, author of Hellstorm. And what's your new book, Michael?
Summer 1945, Germany, Japan, and Harvest of Hate.
Okay, Harvest of Hate.
Yeah, now, it's a follow-up to Hellstorm.
Okay. All right, so what is it that you left out of Hellstorm? Maybe people who haven't heard of Hellstorm, maybe you can give them a quick overview of that book and then tie it into the new book.
All right. Hellstorm was, well, a lot of folks think it was the first time anybody has ever written about what really, really, really happened in World War II. Everything about it, not just one or two aspects of it that some people have very carefully done in the past. This is an attempt to bring it all together, to show you what all was happening, not just certain aspects, but virtually the entire end of the war and the beginning of the so-called peace for Germany. And what I found in the research was staggering, quite honestly, not just for me, the researcher and the writer and the rewriter, but for the people who read the book. They were shocked, stunned, sickened, and of course saddened that these things happened in our name by the so-called greatest generation during the so-called good war. None of that was true, of course. It was the exact opposite. The winners of that war also wrote the history, and so the losers were vilified, demonized, and blamed for every crime possible during World War II. In fact, it's just a classic case of projection. In other words, if you're an evildoer, a criminal, and you want to place the blame elsewhere, well, that's what you do. If you're in control, you just basically blame it on somebody you dislike or hate. And what are they going to do? They can't do anything except accept it. That's what losers in wars do. They don't just lose a war. They actually take the beating of propaganda and this total brainwashing of an entire world about the consequences of that war. By the way, I don't think I should go any further before I just say the absolute truth. Germany was blamed for everything bad in that war, and it was just the opposite. The other side did the bad, did the evil.
Right.
And that's right. What Hellstorm is all about, showing. What do I mean by evil? I mean like firebombing every man, woman, and child in every German city to kill every man, woman, and child
right.
in every German city. That's what I mean by evil. There is no strategy. There's no tactical value of destroying these people in their cities, except that it feels good. It's a sadistic feel good for the Americans and the British. And we can go on talking about so many aspects. In fact, there is a bit of that in this next book. It's Hellstorm deals mostly with the end of the war itself, the fighting, the dying, the slaughter that was going on, and the peace. Some of the peace. Whereas this next book deals with the peace, the so-called peace. It's really not peace at all in this next book in Germany. It's actually war by other means. More people, I think 10 times the number of people died in the so-called peace than died in war. That's the right. American, that's the Allied version of so-called peace. There were so many more things, Pastor James, that I found in this book, Summer 1945. A lot of folks may assume that it's basically a repetition of Hellstorm. It's not. I did a lot of research in this new book, Summer 1945. I found so many things that I didn't know about in Hellstorm. For instance, the massive American rapes. I had always assumed it was just basically the Red Army, the Soviet Union, that raped in the millions, and they did. There is no doubt about it.
Yes.
The Jewish propaganda for Stalin, Ilya Ehrenberg, sent out broadcasts and leaflets to the Soviet army, Soviet soldiers, encouraging them, demanding them that they rape and murder women, the German women and children. Ehrenberg said neither the living or the yet unborn are guiltless. Kill them all. And for the most part, that's what they did. I assumed that this was the most egregious aspect of the rape of German women.
Right.
I don't think it is now. I think the Americans had the worst account.
Really?
From my research. Okay. That's how radical this research has turned me around. Yes, they just did a damn better job of covering your butts on this rape on Western Germany.
I remember my mother telling me about, because they lived in Austria-Hungary before I was born. And she told me that they lived in fear of the Russian soldiers, and they had a trap door in the kitchen that all the women, especially the younger women and the children, would hide under, and they were able to save their lives or at least prevent being raped by this trap door. So this is very common knowledge about the Russian troops.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I shouldn't even call them Russian, Soviet troops. So- yeah.
Yes, Soviets, because you're right about that. That's a distinction that needs to be made, is that not all Russians are white, by the way. Not all Soviet soldiers are. They're Asiatic. In fact, I found in the research of Hellstorm that probably a majority of the rapes and murders on the Eastern Front in Germany itself were committed by Asians, Mongolians especially, Kazakhstans, people like that. But yes, that was my thought, that by far, the Soviets were the worst of the bunch. Now, I'm not sure. I know they were terrible, but the Americans were doing virtually the same thing. Like I mentioned, they just had they had something called the Office of War Information. The Office of War Information, OWI. And this was a gaggle of journalists, hundreds of journalists, who followed the American army through France, Belgium, and into Germany. And their job was to report on the war, so to speak. Actually, their job was nothing but to produce propaganda. They were warned that if they did not toe the line, if they did not praise and honor and glorify the American soldier, especially the American private, if they did not vilify and demonize the German, that they would probably be out of a job, not just with the military, but once back home. They would not be working for any newspaper. It was a They turned what probably were a large group of journalists who were conscientious, diligent reporters in times of peace into nothing but a herd of propagandists in time of war. That's all they were. And these people are the ones that shielded the Americans back home from the news, the actual news of the rapes by their sons and husbands and the murders.
Right.
By their sons. And the the thuggery, general thuggery of American soldiers. Dead. No, greatest generation. Only a Jew or a Jew running dog can come up with the term greatest generation and the good war. It was just the absolute opposite for the Americans as well, and for the Russians too, the Russian soldiers. The only thing it was good for was Jews, basically.
Right.
The Jewish power grid throughout the world. But Hellstorm, a lot of folks... They've made, in fact, this is one of the most common quotes by people who have read Hellstorm, is that there was me, that is the reader, there was me before Hellstorm, now there's me after Hellstorm. I not only look upon World War II differently. I look upon the world differently after reading this book.
Yes.
Because it flips everything on its head. It shows it the way it really was. Not the way we've been told ever since we were born. That we grew up in the shadow of World War II. You know as well as I do what we heard.
Yeah.
It's good war nonsense. To the exact opposite. And my purpose in writing this next book, which I think is my most important book, by the way, Summer 1945, is to show the world that although it was truly terrible, and the focus indeed was on Germany, Jewish interests, this was also worldwide. It was global. This evil had spread throughout the world, and Japan was another nation to suffer desperately, dearly, for its transgression of being a defense. It was a defensive pact with Nazi Germany. Japan, as terrible as Germany was dealt with, I'm not sure that Japan wasn't dealt with worse, actually,
okay,
from my research. But I try to go back and forth in this book, one chapter, Germany in peace, so-called, another chapter, Japan in war. Certainly it was terrible, vicious war. Virtually everything I found out for this next book was something I had never known before, including the German aspects of it. So this book looks at Germany once more with a harder focus about the evil that went on. I was not aware of the incredible degree of torture throughout Germany after the war, during the so-called peace. There's something called the Morgenthau Plan. Henry Morgenthau was FDR's Secretary of Treasury, Jewish Secretary of Treasury, and he hated the Germans. In fact, this Morgenthau Plan was his plan, a plan to not just defeat Germany, but to destroy Germany and its people utterly. And I mean utterly as you could possibly destroy them, that is down to the last person. They had plans during the war to kill as many as they could, and they did a very good job of that. Millions of civilians were killed in these firebombing raids. But after the war, yes, we all know about, I hope we all know about now, Eisenhower's death camps, his deliberate, concerted effort to kill as many helpless, disarmed German POWs as he possibly could. And Eisenhower did a very good job of that.
Yes. What's the total number of Germans, killed in this manner?
Yes, my number is 800,000 to 1.5 million. I wasn't there. I wasn't born yet. But these are from experts, people who have actually studied the situation and come up with figures, 800,000 to 1.5 million helpless, disarmed German POWs after the war in concentration camps were allowed to die from starvation, die of thirst, from dehydration, for God's sake, even though the Rhine River in often cases ran right beside these concentration camps, to die of lack of medical attention, to die in their filthy holes in the ground from all sorts of diseases, to die from actual murder. We're talking ultimate evil when we're talking about America's participation in this war. Eisenhower was the top general. We thought so much of him that we elected him American president a few years after that. Here's a gentleman, I use that term with a real strain of cynicism. Here's a guy who never heard a bullet fired in anger, who when the war when the war was ending, he was in charge, of course, the Allied Army forces in Europe at the time. But when the war was finally ending, he said something like this: "God, I wish we could have killed more of them." In other words, this beast is unhappy with the body count of the world's worst war in history. He's unhappy, so he's determined to kill as many more as he possibly can, according to the Morgenthau Plan. The Morgenthau Plan also made sure that Germans would starve after the war. They withheld food, not just from the soldiers, the POWs, but from the civilians themselves in the cities, in the country. People weren't allowed to grow food. In other words, the Morgenthau Plan was for the civilians, it was starvation, simple, to kill as many. And they were hoping to kill at least 50 million through starvation. And eventually, Germany would be shrunk into such a position after the starvation and the disease had racked the country terribly that it would succumb to its neighbors, people like Poland and Czechoslovakia, who hated the Germans and would have certainly torn into it after the war. This is the Morgenthau Plan. And by the way, the Morgenthau Plan was never official. It was never codified. It was never passed by the legislature, but it was real. It was unspoken, but it was real. It was true. Everybody understood it. All the top leaders, all the top military leaders understood this program. And it has never been rescinded to this day. It's still in place.
And really?
Do you see anything familiar going on right now in Germany? The repopulation of the original Germans. In other words, the so-called immigrants, the third world misfits coming into Germany now, replacing the German population. That is part of the Morgenthau Plan, too. Now, So that's the Morgenthau Plan to this very day. But anyway, like I said, what is in this book now about Germany and peace is something vastly new to me. And I go back and forth between Germany and Japan and try to keep the reader update on what's going on. And I don't know which side is worse, which is the most more gruesome, quite honestly, because the Japanese, I won't go through the whole Pearl Harbor thing. I think you and your listeners are aware enough that you know probably the entire story.
Yes.
How FDR backed them into a corner, a box called Pearl Harbor, with his embargoes and his sanctions and his gunboats. He actually had two U.S. Cruisers in Japanese waters trying to stoke a situation before Pearl Harbor. Did everything in his power to create an incident with Japan so that FDR and his Jewish buddies could get into the European war. That's where they really wanted. They just wanted to get into the European war. They were not worried about Japan at least. Not in the least. Secretary of Navy Knox had said, look, we're going to whip the Japs in 3 months. We all know that. And they did all know that.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your take on the division of Berlin and keeping the Red Army on the eastern side? Pardon?
Yes, that's the way it worked out. To Japan's demise at the end of the war, when the Russians tore up the neutrality pact with Japan and attacked Japan during the dropping of the atomic bombs. There's so many things I did not know about Japan. One of them is, first of all, we all know by osmosis, if nothing else, how much Americans hated and still hate the Japanese because of the Pearl Harbor attack. They still consider the Japs a bunch of sneaky rats. And so right after Pearl Harbor, it was the easiest thing on earth for Hollywood, the media, for the government, for the military, for everybody in America to denigrate, vilify, and turn the Japanese into subhumans, anything but human. They were yellow rats, they were flying vampire bats, they were snakes, they were cockroaches, everything but human. In other words, it's your duty to kill these things. They're not humans. It's your duty to kill these sneaky rats. And that's basically what the American military did. Right from the start, from the very start, when the fighting started on Guadalcanal, the first island invaded by the Americans, this is where the pattern was set, that no Japanese, surrendering Japanese or caught in combat would be a prisoner of war. They would be dead. They would be killed. It's as simple as that. There will be no prisoners. In fact, colonels, when they landed with their men, would say the very same thing. They'd say, you will under no circumstances take any dirty yellow Jap rat, under any circumstances. And this is the top men talking. And so you know very well the privates, they're going to obey this, their officers, and enjoy doing it. Because, as I said, all Americans at that time really, really did hate the Japanese. But after the very first fight on Guadalcanal, the first night of the battle, the Americans mowed most of them down on the beaches. But the next morning, they went back to the sand itself, the beaches, and found many Japanese that were still just wounded. And so they're taking no prisoners. They bayonet every one of them. Kill everyone right there on the spot. And that's the program. After that, you know, we grew up with this idea that the Japanese enjoyed death, loved death. Suicide was second nature to them. Dying for the emperor was their heart's content. It's the thing they wanted most on earth. That's also bogus BS. That was something that excused what the Americans were doing to the Japanese. That is murdering them all in cold blood, taking no prisoners. It's easy to kill somebody when you say, well, he wasn't going to surrender anyway. He was just going to do something treacherous or whatever. Snake. Japanese tried surrendering very early at that first battle of Guadalcanal. Many of them knew that this war was a lost cause because they've been fighting for 11 years against China, had still not won that war. Now they're up against one of the greatest powers on earth. These men aren't stupid. They know these things. And so now they're faced with an overwhelming army on Guadalcanal. They're heavily outnumbered. Many of them want to go back home. They want to survive this battle and this war, to marry that sweetheart, to have those kids that they would love to have, to raise a family, to raise a garden, have pets. And so some of them try to surrender. They throw down their guns, they raise their hands, they walk forward while their comrades are still watching in the background, in the weeds, in the trees. And immediately they're all shot down, mowed down with machine guns, and then bayoneted later. The soldiers who saw this, you can imagine what they saw, what they think. In other words, wow, if that's what happens when you try to surrender to the Americans, count me out. I'm not going there. I'll fight to the death before I go through this. And even what follows after that it convinces them even more that there will be no, can be no surrender in this war. The Americans love torturing Japanese, the ones that were still alive. Love torturing them. That's a simple fact. Cutting off ears, noses, while the Japanese are still alive, stringing them like with rawhide for necklaces, kicking out their gold teeth, or knocking them out with knives. You can imagine what torture is. Well, that's what this is. It's torture. Cutting off their genitals, sticking it in their mouths while they throw them into a pit with dead Japanese that have already been thrown in there. We're talking, and there's no officer there stopping it. No American officer demanding that this stop, this treatment, this behavior. There is none. The only officer I found that said anything, and even he could not say it loud enough for the entire army to hear, was Charles Lindbergh. He seemed to be the only man of conscience in that entire damned army. He said, look, it's stupid to be killing them. Even if you feel like killing an enemy, a wounded enemy, whatever, it's stupid because what you're doing is forcing them to dig in and dig in deep and fight to the death against you. They're going to kill many of you yourselves when you perform like this. Lindbergh was the only man with heart and sense, in my opinion. But I seem to be rattling on here pretty quick, and I haven't had any coffee, so it's, I don't know what it's about, but I'm just trying to tell you the story, I guess, as quickly time we have. But the Japanese, this was the template, this was the pattern scenario that played out on every island the Americans invaded. Virtually there were no Japanese prisoners. They were all killed either in combat, or the Japanese killed themselves with suicide, or the Americans just slaughtered them outright. And this goes on and on. In fact, there's so many harrowing tales. I did the best job I possibly could with the few survivors there were, with reading Japanese diaries and journals. Of course, there were very few survivors left, so I had nobody at old age to talk about their experiences. They were all dead. So I went with these diaries. And it's heartbreaking because the more you read these things, the few that there are, but the more you read these Japanese diaries, the more they read like American diaries or like a British diary. Or a Canadian diary or a German diary. They read like us. They sound like us. In other words, man, I wish I could get out of this, but they're not leaving us any door to open to get out, to surrender, that is. I miss my mom and dad. And here's something else that's really startling. After a battle, after a terrible massacre, many men would rummage through Japanese pockets trying to find gold, money, whatever it is, food even. And they often ran across photographs of Japanese parents and families back home. They were startled because we're used to all the posters and the terrible propaganda against the Japanese. It's everything but human, long ears, buck teeth, looking just ridiculous and certainly not human. And yet you see these people, one American officer who was collecting these photographs of the families, He said, I have never seen people more honorable or dignified or civilized looking than these parents. And that's what one American officer said in one of the accounts. And here's some other things about the Japanese that no American really wanted to admit, how very much they were like themselves. Japanese soldiers also carried pinups of movie stars in their helmets, just like American soldiers did. Betty Grable and Rita Hayworth. Japanese did the same thing. They carried baseball stats in their pockets from baseball teams back in Japan, just like Americans would, with the Brooklyn Dodgers, the New York Yankees. There were so many characteristics so similar to each side.
Yeah.
They were far more, they were far less different than one might imagine. But Pastor James, you got any questions? I just tend to go on.
Yeah. Well, do either of your books deal with the Operation Keel Haul?
Yes. In fact, the German half of the book does deal with Operation Keel Haul. Certainly one of the greatest acts of treachery in world history. There may be mainly one that's more treacherous, deceitful, and evil. I'll mention just briefly what that is to the listeners, probably many of you know. At the end of the war, roughly 5 million Russians, Cossacks, Ukrainians, Belarus, people like that, were in Germany or Austria or somewhere in Central or Western Europe at the end of the war. And these are Russians, like I said, they came from a Soviet. They're Soviet soldiers, so ex-soldiers, and some of them are family members. And Stalin demanded that all these people be repatriated back to the Soviet Union. And the Americans and British basically told these people that were in their control, don't worry, don't worry. We'll never make you go back to Stalin. We know what he'll do to you. He'll either send you to Siberia or more than likely just kill you. And the people were greatly relieved, especially people like the Cossacks, who were a rather naive, trusting sort of individual. But guess what? The Americans and British did just the opposite of what they told these poor people and delivered them back with brutality. They actually had to beat them, sometimes even kill them, if you can imagine, to return them to Stalin and his executioners. But, yep, they sure enough, they pulled this off. It was one of the greatest acts of deceit in history. Eisenhower had nothing but smug, easy, confident words about how America is a democratic, loving country, would never send back people against their will. He made statements like that afterwards. Yeah, Eisenhower was truly one of the most devilish, evil men I've ever met in my life. Franklin Delano Roosevelt is worse, but that was Operation Keel Haul, and I'm just barely touching the surface of that news.
So we see that the Russian people and related people were expecting to be liberated, and said they were sent back to Russia under Stalin's communism. Mm-hmm. It's incredible that, there's one book written about that subject that I'm aware of. But it's one of those forgotten topics about World War II.
Yeah. I think was it the one by Tolstoy? Man named Tolstoy.
I'm not sure.
The fact is, too, we can accept the fact now that the Americans and the British, we were fighting for communism. We were fighting for the Soviet Union, its survival, and handing back, doesn't that make more sense if you're allied with the communists that you would hand back for punishment, for death, for slavery, rather than keep them for yourselves? In other words, these are anti-communists. Most of them fought against the communists with the Germans. Others just simply didn't want to be in communism anymore. So for the Americans and British to keep them, they would be keeping anti-communists, and we're anything but anti-communists, quite honestly. It sounded good in the Cold War. In the Cold War, it did come around to two great nations actually fighting for one another. I don't think politics had anything to do with it, quite honestly. It was just two large nations, one who wanted more than the other. Because I think the United States this very day is more communist than Republican or Democrat, quite honestly.
That's true, yes.
But Anyway, any more questions? You've got
Yeah, getting back to the division of Eastern and Western Germany, who made the decision to put Berlin under Western control while it was surrounded? Was that a Morgenthau deal?
I'm sure it was. Yeah, I'm sure it was. FDR, and then Truman, of course, right after him, Eisenhower. We're talking some really despicable individuals. Eisenhower, of course, allowed the Soviet army to attack, surround, and capture this beautiful, or formerly beautiful, this one of the world's largest capitals, Berlin, when the Americans could have easily, in fact, the Germans would have allowed them to take Berlin. Virtually without a fight, but no, Eisenhower gave it as a gift to Stalin, and I'm sure at the behest of first Roosevelt, and then after he died, Truman. But yeah, so that's the war, and we're supposed to believe that we won the war. We won.
Yeah.
No, it
was the communists. It was the communists who won. Yeah. Yeah.
White men, but it was civil war between whites. And that's what they're trying to prod us into right now. Another civil war of whites, Russia and the U.S. Another white civil war. Anyway, that's off the subject a little bit. But Japanese, I talk about the battles, of course. You can't talk about the war with Japan unless you do talk about the land battles. But it was pretty much the way I've described it right there, all the way through to the end, including Okinawa. Something I found out, though, about the kamikaze pilots during the Battle of Okinawa, that's when they were getting in their airplanes. And back when I was a kid, we used to think of them as nothing but robots, robotic pilots who had no emotions, had no feelings, weren't really human. They just simply got into a plane and dove into the first boat they could find and enjoyed it, actually enjoyed it, because after all, that's suicide, and they love suicide. Yeah. Not at all. I read so many Japanese letters back home, diaries, talking to their children. What these individuals really were, now perhaps not all of them, but 99% of them were, I'm going to tell you, were patriotic Japanese who wanted to give that last full measure for their nation, for their families. And that was what we're talking about with the kamikazes, to try to slow down this enormous juggernaut, America, and prevent it from actually taking over, occupying, defeating the nation utterly. And
homeland.
This was a little bit like the Alamo, in which the men fought.
Right.
Some men tried to slow down Santa Anna and his Mexican army, and they did a pretty good job of it, by the way. So, in other words, these were what we qualify as a quintessential patriot, the people at the Alamo fighting to the death, so that their nation might live, their new nation, Texas. And of course, the United States later on. Japanese were doing the same thing with the kamikaze attacks. Funny thing, though, no, it's not funny. terrible thing about kamikaze is that it was a massacre.
Yeah.
It was a massacre. The Japanese were in slow, unmaneuverable airplanes. The pilots themselves were inexperienced and green, and they're going up against this extremely experienced American Air Force. In fact, probably 75% of all kamikaze airplanes never even saw a U.S. boat, a U.S. ship, before they were shot out of the air by American fighter planes. Probably 75%. And then the other, another 20%, when they did see the U.S. ships, were blown out of the air by the ships themselves. Hundreds of guns and machine guns and cannons. But when the one did hit a ship, when the one kamikaze or two did hit a ship, it was a big time. It was a big deal. And it caused some real havoc. They were loaded with bombs. When they got through in their slow aircraft, and inexperienced pilots, they sank something like 32 ships during the fight for Okinawa. And it was devastating. The psychological impact on the U.S. Navy sailors themselves was the greatest.
It
was the greatest victory for the kamikaze. But overall, no, it was a failure. Just like every other fight with the U.S. had been a failure. The Americans never lost any fight with the Japanese. Remember what I said, that even American leaders said, look, we can wipe Japan off the face of the earth in 3 months. Well, that was true. And when they finally turned their full attention on Japan after the war in Europe, it was just no contest. No contest at all. The Japanese Air Force was destroyed. So was the Navy. We're talking about defending Japan itself against an American invasion. And yet they had nothing to defend it with. They were going to use sharpened bamboo poles to fight tanks. And they were using wooden bullets to fight airplanes and ships.
Jeez.
So the Japanese were utterly defeated. In fact, in January of 1945, the Japanese asked for surrender. They contacted the Americans and said, we give up. We surrender. We're defeated. Okay, we'll give up. This is January 45. This is 8 months before the bombs, the big bombs.
Right.
Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Throughout the summer, they two more times asked to surrender. We're through. We've got nothing else. How many times does a nation have to surrender or try to surrender? We're talking three right there, and there are probably more. The U.S. refused. FDR refused, laughed at the peace offerings. Basically, he was enjoying the war, and so were the American people. They still hated the Japanese so badly. They didn't want the war to be over. I mean, this is the way wars are supposed to be, easy and won. Absolutely easy to be won, and that's the way it was going against Japan. To make a long story short, I point out in this book that the atomic bombs were utterly, absolutely not necessary. Absolutely. There is not a question. There should be a question in no one's mind after they read this. Everything is right there. Even the comments of some of the major generals, some of the top generals and admirals, talking about how absolutely unnecessary the atomic bombs were. It just felt good. It was another form of hate, another form of sadism. And Truman, that's what he wanted, basically. What really ended the war was the declaration of war by the Soviets. Just around that period, when the bombs were dropped, the Japanese knew, hey, look, we can't even defeat one enormous superpower, much less two. We've got to get out of this thing, or they're going to turn us all into a bunch of communists, in other words. So how the war ended, in essence. There's lots of other things. The Americans, we talked a little bit about the rape in Europe of German womanhood. And by the way, there may be some folks out there listening, perhaps younger people, who think of rape as a terrible thing. Something that's, it's awful. It's despicable. Yeah. It's a terrible thing. But it's still, the person lives. The person goes on. They can get on with their life. But you know something from the, I've read so many accounts now of rape in war, especially, that I've come to a different conclusion on this. No, rape is a form of death. It's a form of spiritual slaughter of the woman itself. In cases like war, it's even more egregious, more aggravated than, say, rape in peacetime in an American city or whatever. That's terrible, too. Don't get me wrong. But in war, the penis is the weapon all the way through, and they use it again and again and again and again and again. Gang rape is the form of rape in war. So there is nothing passive or nothing acceptable about rape in war, just because a woman may, in theory, survive. Most of them are transformed utterly. Traumatic is not even a good word to use in this case.
Many devastating.
Women are spiritually dead. Yes, truly.
Yeah.
But the Americans did this perhaps even to as great extent as the Soviet army did, which is, we're talking millions upon millions of German women being raped.
Uh-huh.
And children, too, by 8 to 80. Yeah. That's the range of age they raped. I never imagined, for some reason, that they did it in Japan, but they did. In fact, Saipan and Okinawa, the first two Japanese-held islands that actually had Japanese civilians on them, including, of course, women and children, that's where the Americans added rape to their menu.
Yeah.
Rape to the menu of massacre, murder, and helpless prisoners, and other terrible things. On Saipan, there were probably 30,000 Japanese civilians, of whom I assume roughly half were females, and virtually all of these were raped. The Americans went right to work with their gang rape. Let's put it this way. The officers weren't stopping the slaughter of helpless Japanese prisoners of war or the wounded. Why would they stop the rape in Japan on Japanese islands? They weren't stopping the rape in Germany, that's for sure, or France, even a technically allied country. So why would they stop it in Japan? They did. In fact, on Okinawa, tens of thousands of women were raped during the battle, and then, of course, after the battle. The Americans killed almost all of the Japanese occupation forces. And then when the war was finally over and the Americans finally accepted the Japanese surrender after the atomic bombs and after the Russians got in the war, the Soviets, then the Americans got serious about rape on Japan itself. Even before General MacArthur landed on Japan to take office as the new dictator, the governor, you might say, of Japan, Marines and soldiers were already raping and sailors. And this went on for until 1947 at least, and probably way beyond that even too. My book doesn't go beyond that, so I don't know. But rape. We don't think of it as American because Americans have been protected by this group of individuals, the Office of War Information, and other people, of course, paid running dogs of the system of Jewish hegemony in America, like Tom Brokaw, the guy who talked about the greatest generation. That was his term, was it not? Yes, the greatest generation. Running dogs like that are the ones that keep the propaganda alive, keep it going. Now, however, there's some new knowledge coming out, a lot of new knowledge. And the Americans were, I mean, as awful as it, I never imagined that my fellow Americans would rape to the degree they did with the absolute indifference. Indifference. They enjoyed it. They laughed about it. It was fun. It was humiliated the enemy woman, so to speak, the enemy woman. Yes. And it was good. It felt good. It was fun. I could do it. All my buddies are doing it too. And so we know what's going on in the Middle East right now. Americans just don't change in a generation or two. I mean, if they're rapists World War II, and they were, they're rapists right now in the Middle East. Because I'm telling you straight, the officers are no better than the men. And if the officers didn't stop them in World War II, they're not going to stop them now in the Middle East. I mean, Middle Eastern, the Islam, Muslims have been vilified to the degree of the Japanese and Germans, let's face it, to the Japanese at least. So why would they give them a break when they didn't, the Germans or the Japanese? So we know pretty well what's going on in the Middle East from what went on in World War II. Again, I got to slow down a little bit and see if you have any questions.
Well, what's your take on Korea? Because that's another war that we had no business getting involved in. And it sounds like another Jewish setup all over again.
I've got to really learn on that, Reverend James. I'll tell you what, I was a creature of the movies I watched as a kid. Yeah, I saw so many American fighting Korean movies that I just hated the North Koreans and their mechanical way of fighting. They blow trumpets, they blow horns, things like that, and it just seemed so alien to my nature. And even as I grew up, even in middle age, I never cared if we blew North Korea right off the face of the map, because I more or less bought into the BS that's been put out by, everybody right up now until Trump, about how, the fact is, a nation as small as Korea, what in the hell are they going to do to protect themselves from a monster like the evil U.S.? Nothing. What are they going to do? Of course they're going to have to stick together and stay as hard and fast with each other as they possibly can if they're going to survive. Yep, you better get yourself some nuclear weapons. You see what happens to other nations that don't have them. The United States is all over them, destroying them, turning them back into the rock piles they were. That's what happens. You're threatened. Eventually, you're occupied, destroyed, you're massacred. You're, everything you worked for, fought for, is stolen from you, destroyed. That's what happens. That North Korea, by the way, actually hung together there for quite a few years. Now, I hope this is all over. I hope this business is all over. I hope North and South Korea come together, form one unified nation, and become as great as they possibly can. You're seeing what the South Koreans have been doing with technology, science.
Right.
I mean, that's what the world needs. We don't need any more African basket cases like that. We don't need to be constantly giving out welfare to Africa and every other primitive bunch of people on Earth. At least the South Koreans and hopefully the North Koreans will be paying their own ticket in this world. Yes. So I'm all for it. And America just seems to always need wars and people to vilify and attack. Well, it'll be one less. Maybe North Korea will pull out of this. And that's hoping for a lot, I realize. But one of these days, America will get its teeth kicked out. And then we'll know what it's like to lose a war. And then probably not for 1,000 years will any American ever even whisper the word war.
Yeah.
War. War. We've never been really defeated. The American Civil War was as close as we got.
Right.
But if we ever get our teeth kicked out, like Russia is certainly capable of doing, and it seems like China is coming there really quick too. If that ever happens, I'll guarantee you we'll get out of the war racket.
Yes, yes. Well, actually, a lot of your descriptions of German and Japanese rapes harken back to Reconstruction during the Civil War, when the white people of the South were basically lorded over by the U.S. military, under the radical abolitionists. Andrew Johnson tried to prevent that from happening, and he was impeached over it, because he had a very lenient policy toward the Southerners. But then the radical abolitionists, who in my opinion were actually agents of the Rothschilds. If you're not familiar with my work on the Civil War, the Rothschilds actually staged the Civil War. One Rothschild family supported the North and supported the anti-slavery movement, and the other Rothschild family supported slavery in the South. And they brought the two forces together to smash America, right? So, again, here you see the Jews playing both ends against the middle. And just like you're saying about World War II, the real story has never been told. Has never been told. It's nothing but myth. And all we ever hear about is the myth of the 6 million, when you're talking about 100 million or more white people being slaughtered during World War I and World War II, and nobody bats an eye, nobody makes any movies about that. And somebody said that the 20th century was the Jewish century, and that proves that it was the Jewish century, because the Jews and their communist allies won over Europe. There's no doubt about that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, I didn't know about your book, because, to be honest, I don't read much, and I write more than I read. Didn't know about my book either. I wrote a book on the very subject. But no, not the Rothschilds. Mine was just more superficial, you might say. It's called The Day Dixie Died. And it's about that first year of occupation. You're right. It's very similar to what happened in Hellstorm, what the Americans and British did to the Germans in World War II. What happened to the South in that first year after the war is very similar to what happened to the Germans. Of course, after Lincoln's assassination, the story. I'm not going to go through it again for you. Yeah. note what you're saying too. It makes much sense. It makes much sense to assume that wars just begin naturally, or, a toss of a dice or something. No, people are hungry for this thing. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. But, Yeah, Judah B. Benjamin was a Rothschild agent in the South. He was a handler for Jefferson Davis, and August Belmont, whose real name was Schoenberg, was the handler of the North, the banker. So these are the guys pulling all the strings, and there were a lot of Freemasons involved. Do any of your books deal with that subject, Freemasons? and secret societies?
No. And to be honest, I consider myself only an expert on certain things, not politics. Military, I'm pretty good on that. And I hate to call it superficial stuff, but I leave that to better people like yourself to do these things, because I like a little more excitement in mine, a little less politics, if you know what I mean. Hey, there's something I need to mention that maybe your listeners don't know a lot about. I dang sure didn't. And that's, we're back to the atomic bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Uh-huh. I'll bet you know this, that Nagasaki had the largest Christian church in Asia. And it had some of the, Nagasaki and Hiroshima had two of the largest Christian populations in all of Asia.
Yes, yes.
And did you know that the church in Nagasaki was the target, was ground zero for the bomb dropped in Nagasaki? Yeah. And that they were actually holding a mass that morning inside the church. But this is what I really wanted to throw at you. I won't get into the terrible aspects of the nuclear bombs, the attacks. You probably read something of that, maybe a lot of it. It was horrific, just horrific. People being vaporized.
Yes.
People's eyes actually melting out of their heads, humans and animals, and so on. But when the Americans occupied Japan after the bombs, MacArthur slapped an utter, total censorship over all of Japan, just like in Germany, except probably even more so in Japan. Nothing escaped Japan unless MacArthur allowed it to escape. In other words, virtually nothing, including the starvation of Japan, by the way. Japan was being starved just like Germany, people dropping dead. And this was their way of punishment. But things like that never came out. Something else that never came out was the aftermath of the atomic bombs. Not only the aftermath, but what the bombs were really like. Americans wanted these as viable weapons forever and ever. And they didn't want the American public hearing terrible stories about the atomic bombs, what they were really like. And so MacArthur slapped an utter censorship on Japan. Doctors could not even talk about potential treatments for some of the people who suffered from the atomic bombs. People could not take photographs of the destroyed construction or of people. If they did, their cameras were either destroyed or the negatives burned. Even people sending postcards and letters could not mention what happened there. But eventually, of course, over the next year, 2 years, bits and pieces, little bits of information did get out. And some of it was hair-raising, of course. Some of the Americans started catching wind of some of this stuff. Eventually, Congress demanded that Major General Leslie Groves, the commander of the Manhattan Project, which was the entity that actually created the atomic bombs, he was called Congress to answer a few questions. And some of the congressmen were asking him about what is this thing called radiation sickness? What happens to somebody? What goes on? And Leslie Groves, of course, was under orders to answer as little as possible. And then if he did have to answer anything, make it as pleasing as you possibly could. And so he had some of the most ridiculous things to say to these congressmen. They wanted to know about radiation sickness. And Leslie Groves said, look, it's not as bad as anybody might think as you heard. In fact, I've heard it from very good sources that dying from radiation sickness is not such a bad way to die. In fact, it's a rather pleasurable way to die. Yes, while he was saying such nonsense to the members of Congress, at that very moment, probably hundreds, thousands maybe, were in Japan dying from radiation sickness as they, in streams of blood, vomited out their internal organs that were disintegrating in their bodies. And so maybe he could tell them that it's not such a bad way to die. Maybe they might even believe him. I don't think so. Yeah. Things like that. Eventually, of course, word did get out about it. more and more people around the world decided, hey, this is something we better really put up. It's like the old mustard gas from World War One. We've really got to put a kibosh on this because this is terrible stuff. But that's what I wanted to add to it. There's lots of other stuff. The book is going to be my most powerful book. I won't say the best. I don't like to call any book like this the best or good. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you don't enjoy this book or the Hellstorm.
Right.
But I think it's going to have more, I believe it'll be more widely accepted around the world than Hellstorm, because we're talking global here now. We're not talking just Europe, just Germany. We're talking about the world. And the things that happened to Germany and Japan are so similar that only the same evil could be responsible for this.
Right.
That's how similar the terror and the awfulness of it are. And so that's the reason I think it's going to be my most powerful book, because it'll resonate with even more people.
Yes. Okay. All right. We're coming up to the top of the hour break. There's the music, and I just want to mention a couple other events that took place in 1945 that we could talk about, very important events, okay? So we'll be right back, folks.
FreedomSlips.com. I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion. You can find me on Studio B every Thursday at 1700 hours Pacific Time. That's 8 p.m. Eastern. No topic taboo, no subject too strange. I strive to take a neutral standpoint during the dissection of the topic at hand. That's Reality Extraction with Mr. Rowe on Revolution Radio.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, 6 to 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We are your hosts, Pamela
and Claire, on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Featuring the public law to us, Lyme disease
and astrology. Witnessing those who harm and holding them accountable.
Guess what? No more secrets. It's about time we snap out of it. This corporate government is a house of cards falling in on itself. The public law. Do no harm.
Nicholas Commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard. You've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look. It's just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, and stupidity.
I'll do you for that. Oh, what? Come here. What are you going to do, bleed on me? I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs.
Roundtable Live, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and freedomslips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Oh, okay, ladies and gentlemen, Pastor Eli James here, along with Michael, and this is a discussion of his two books. The I love your symbol here, Smash Cultural Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Okay, Michael Goodrich is my guest today, and we're talking about World War II, and his second book is 1945. The German and Japanese experience after World War II, right? And so you talked about... Go ahead.
Well, I should say for your listeners, yeah, Michael Thomas Goodrich is my name. Actually, I write under Thomas Goodrich. That may be where people could find me quicker.
Oh, okay.
Thomas Goodrich for books. But
see.
But I was actually born Michael Thomas Shainline. Born Michael Thomas Shainline, then adopted. Excuse me, adopted later. You mentioned 1945, German Japan, and the Harvest of Aid. Yeah, that's it's been out a couple of weeks now, and I think it's going to do really well. At least I'm hoping. Of course, every author needs to make money, but there's also that. Something that runs really second or sometimes even first, you want to make a difference in the world.
Yes.
You want to make an impact. You want to make a world better. You don't want to wake up someday looking up at the lights above you as you're, 5 seconds away from dying and ask yourself, what did I do with my life? You want to have an answer. You want to say, I did the best I could. And right now, I've got a lot to do because I could look up at that light, ask that question, and still not come up with the answer that I want, that I did the best I could. I can still do better. And that's what I plan on doing with what what I have left. Can you hear me okay at this point?
Yes.
Can you?
Yeah.
All right.
Fine. Okay. Absolutely fine.
It's weakening by degrees here.
Okay. My voice has been that way from the start. Okay. But I want to bring a little bit of conspiracy talk into the discussion here. The murder of General Patton. And this happened in 1945, December, I think he had his accident on December 9th, 1945. And he had a broken neck, but he was recovering. And then all of a sudden he died on December 22nd, 1945. Now we know that Patton did not want to pursue a punitive policy against the Germans. Are you familiar with any of that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And it was Eisenhower, Ike the Kike, as we like to call him. Eisenhower absolutely hated the German people. He was appointed by Bernard Baruch of the FDR administration. FDR's administration was riddled with Zionists and communists, and they basically controlled America under FDR. In fact, what was his name? You talked about one of the generals in the Pacific, MacArthur. Mm-hmm. MacArthur and Eisenhower were involved in putting down the Bonus Army demonstrations, I believe it was 1932, while before FDR took office. And they put that revolt down with great violence. And so it was Ike the Kike and Douglas MacArthur who simply attacked physically and with tanks, weapons of all kinds, and put down. Now, the Bonus Army was simply trying to gain what the government had promised them, namely the money that the government owed them from their participation in World War I. Okay? Mm-hmm. So here we have our government committing violent acts against our own soldiers, mm-hmm. basically throwing them under the bus. So if anybody thinks that our government under the Jews has been an honorable deed or an honorable study, think again that your comment.
Yeah, history's just shot through with such examples. Let's not forget John F. Kennedy.
All right.
Let's put it this way. Patton seems like an awfully big target, but then so was John F. Kennedy, and so have other people I could name. They were being used, utterly being used. And of course, today in the Middle East, it's pretty clear. Israel's wars for Israel. We fight them, we die in them, and we also pay for them, which is that's where we're at. What happens when your worst enemy takes control of your government, your culture, your life. This is what happens. Yeah, right. It's a trash culture. It's a culture that it's really not a culture as we know it. It's a trash culture, a hate-filled, violent, pornographic culture that's nobody in their right mind would want to live in this. And
Run by Jews, absolutely.
Yes, our worst enemies. People right now who are talking about how great it'll be when they see the last live white man. Jewish academics right now are notorious for making such comments.
Blaming us for their evil deeds, yes.
Yes. And if we keep putting up with such things like that and the massacre of South Africans, at what point do we say that's enough? No more of this.
Yeah.
No more of this.
Yeah.
Having lived longer than I probably should, I suppose I'm one of the greatest practitioners of go along to get along type of thing. But still, I even wonder, how much longer, how much further can we possibly go at this rate? Is our capacity for punishment infinite? Is there any point?
Apparently so,
yes.
Yeah. Our capacity for slavery is incrementally increased every day.
Yes, and someone like Patton, I never thought much about that. Of course, during the movie Patton with George C. Scott, great movie, by the way. They just sort of fade away. They don't really give you any thoughts about what might have really happened to Patton. And it's only been in the last 10 years that I've actually given thought to Patton and what he said. Patton, it's a pity that Patton had an epiphany so late in life. In other words, during the war, he finally realized that he was on the wrong side and said as much. He said, we were fighting on the wrong side. And it's true. Of course we were.
Yeah.
It's terrible that he didn't think that way before the war and just simply did not fight against the Germans, perhaps even fought for them, but he didn't. But at least he was coming around, and that's what they were afraid of, no doubt.
Right.
I'm not saying they did kill Patton. I'm not saying it was a deliberate murder. Let's put it this way. Who gains? Who stands to gain? Yeah. That's what cops ask.
Right. We won't know. Right. Yeah.
With Patton out of the way, everything got a lot better.
Yeah, that's right. Well, often when I turn to conspiracy authors, I actually go to people in other countries. Like this author here, if I can make out his name, Dr. Syed Mujahid Kamran, teacher, physicist, author. And the article is entitled The Murder of General Patton. General Patton, after whom the Patton tank is named, was the most outstanding, the most daring, the most original, and the most honest Allied general during World War II. I'd say that's a fair statement, right?
While Eisenhower was rounding up millions of Germans that he had planned on killing, Patton had actually turned his loose, just like Bernard Montgomery for the British, for the field marshal. Eisenhower rescinded Patton's orders allowing the Germans loose, and so they were brought back.
Yes.
Apparently, even who's the other general that was Patton's sidekick? In the movie he was played by Carl Malden, I believe.
Not familiar with
Omar Bradley.
Oh, okay, yeah.
He had turned his Germans loose too, and then Eisenhower called him back because he wanted them all dead. Simple as that.
Yeah. Ike the Kike. Evil man. Evil. That's all he can say about him. Just pure evil. Yeah, yeah. He said, he says here, on account of his fiery integrity, brilliance, and exceptional bravery, lesser generals like Eisenhower, even though they were senior to him, feared General Patton. His successes had made him a legend during his lifetime. It is now known that General Patton was murdered on the express orders of the chief of the OSS, Office of Strategic Services, the precursor of the CIA, General Wild Bill Donovan, which, of course, the OSS prosecuted the Nuremberg trials, which is, of course, a Jewish prosecution of more innocent Germans. Okay. The British tutored and controlled the OSS through him, and Britain was controlled by the High Cabal, a term used by Churchill during World War II. The High Cabal is also known as the One World Cabal, or the elite in literature. Let's just call a spade a spade. The rich, the high Jew bank. The High Cabal of Churchill was controlled by the Rothschilds because they controlled Britain's money line. Donovan was thus an agent of the elite, the One World Cabal of international bankers and their allies, which is what, if I hadn't read this, I would have assumed all this to be true, right? Excuse me. So you go to outside of American and British literature, you find these people writing about these things and bringing in the conspiracy aspect. And this is what other people know about America and about Britain and about all of these countries that are controlled by Jews today, that we have no authentic history of anything since World War One. No authentic history written by any academic historian. None. Okay. So that's why your books fill the gap in this undoing the legends of the victors. Of course, the victors always write the history books. And the Jews have been the victors in all of these wars and nobody else. Okay. Your comment?
Well, yeah, that's the lack of academic contribution to history is understandable because they'll lose their jobs and they need their jobs to keep the families fed, things like that. I get that. I understand that. It's a terrible situation. I've known many good academic historians that simply cannot come right out and tell the truth as they would love to do because it's not going to be doing them or too many other people any good if they lose their job, if they're living under a bridge somewhere, trying to write a history. In other words, it's not easy, man, to write honest, accurate history. It is not. Yes, I mean in the literal sense, it's I find writing easy, quite honestly. But in the figurative sense, there's no money in it. Hell, right. I mean, I've been poor all my life. Well, I've been poor ever since I started turning my attention toward neglected subjects. And right. That would probably be with the Indian War. That was would probably be the first subject that was extremely controversial. I actually found a mainstream press for that, though, and it actually did pretty well. Made me some money, that one did, because it was a part of the Doubleday Book Club. It was the,
oh, wow.
It was the lead book of the Book of the Monks Club for the History of the Book Club and the Military Book Club. Did pretty well because it resonated with people. Uh-huh. So many people, including academics, who can't say the truth, recognize right. the essential truth in what I was saying. In the history of the Indian Wars, especially those right. on the High Plains, and how they were playing out, they were nothing like the Hollywood version of Dances with Wolves or Little Big Man. This was
yeah.
truth as well as I could tell it on both sides, not
yes.
just a not yeah. just a diatribe against Indians. Indians
right.
were some of the most savage people on earth.
Yes, they were. Yeah.
They lived for torture, quite honestly. They tried to capture people alive for torture.
Yeah.
They had become extremely proficient at torture. There's no doubt about this. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't some aspects of Indian life that were not admirable to a point. Yes, that idea about if you got into a man's teepee, even if he was at war with you, you were safe. That's a wonderful thing. That's almost sounds like Vikings or something.
Right.
But no, save the last bullet for yourself. That was a comment among the soldiers.
Yeah.
Don't ever allow an Indian to get a hold of you. Kill yourself
right.
first.
Yeah.
That's very simple, very similar to what the Japanese said. They also saved the last bullet for themselves against the Americans. If you didn't, you could see what had happened. You would be
yes.
tortured, sometimes for days. Actually, they've had Japanese laying around tortured for days. I'm not making this stuff up. It sounds almost incredible, unbelievable, about what the Americans did to the Japanese. And by
right.
the way, what was going on in Germany wasn't much better. The Americans simply took no prisoners anywhere. Now, some right. Germans, of course, did survive combat to reach a POW camp behind American lines, but many more did not. They were simply either mowed down as they moved forward. We're talking about during war, too. Old men and boys with the Home Guard, the Volkssturm, and then those who actually got into the American lines were beaten, almost always beaten badly, and then many of them, of course, were killed going
right.
back to POW camp. But when they started surrendering into millions at the end of the war, then Eisenhower couldn't simply mow them all down. That would be a mountain of bodies that he'd have to explain
sure.
to everybody. So
he
did it the other way by allowing them to starve to death. But you know, the conspiracy stuff, I've never gotten into that too much because it's to be quite honest, it's something I know nothing about, and it's very time consuming, as you
yes,
know
it is.
Very well. I mean, if you're going to be successful, you've got to be accurate. You've got to be
yes.
as accurate as you can, or otherwise you're just passing on more propaganda.
Right.
But I've never apparently either had the time or the patience, maybe the intelligence, I'm not sure, to figure out what is really true in this thing. However, sometimes conspiracy creeps into me. 9/11, for instance, the Kennedy assassination, it's almost impossible to escape. Again, I've got many cops in my family, and that's one of the main questions a cop always asks: who stands to gain from something?
Right.
That's where you look at first. And if you can nail that, you've pretty much got the culprit. 9/11, that's an easy one.
It is.
It's not even hard. It's not difficult at all.
Yeah. But we're fed such a constant stream of lies by the fake stream media that we can't. It's impossible to counter it. Well, because they can censor us so easily. Okay. So that's where we're at. You know, they can censor us. So, but that is slowly breaking down. I see more and more people being open-minded, and the SPLC and ADL are really fretting about conspiracy theories, right? And those of us who promote them. Excuse me. So anyway, okay. I think at this point, since both of our voices are not in the greatest of shape. By the way, one more question. What are your sources for these, these Japanese and German, you said diaries, you read some of the diaries. What are your other official records of these tortures, etc.?
That's interesting. Stuff comes out every year. Valuable information that's never been known before. They're laying hidden someplace, and somebody decides to publish them. You can follow the information backwards and make sure they're true and legitimate. Every year, it's not a static thing. History is evolving. And a lot of this stuff was new, I found, for the German. And of course, the Japanese, virtually everything is new. But for the German accounts, people are always coming forward. A new account, something that's verifiable. And that, in my case, it's always got to be verifiable. I don't take anybody's word for anything anymore. Too many people, for obvious reasons.
Yeah, you're a cynic.
You might say.
Yeah, you have to be. You have to be to talk about true history, because the evil behind it is just too great to be ignored. Cannot ignore it. Okay. All right. Thank you for being my guest today. And, maybe we can do this again in the future when my voice is better and you've had a fresh. Yeah.
Your voice. You've got a bit of an illness. Yeah, I'm just old. I'm 3 score 10 years old. And my voice, I could boom all day with the best of them, I think. But no more.
Right. No. Okay.
It really runs down quick.
Yeah, here we are writing books that nobody wants to read, but a trickle. Hopefully the trickle will turn into a flood. So thanks for writing those two books and giving people insight on what really happened in World War II.
Well, let me say this to anybody listening out there who's been curious about anything we've said. You can go on Amazon.com, and my books are there, or Barnes & Noble, or Books a Million, or even my own website, thomasgoodrich.com, and buy these books, $20 in the U.S., $25 abroad, or my PayPal account, mtgoodrich@aol.com, and I can send you a copy. But Pastor, it's been my pleasure. You're a gentleman.
Yes.
I would like to talk to you someday when your voice is up there.
Yeah, and, right.
But I'm going to be older, don't forget.
Yeah. Yeah. You just have to take voice lessons, right? La da 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 da. Okay.
Thank you for providing this opportunity.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Goodrich. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. All right, folks. Pastor Eli James here. And I'm going to play some tapes here for the balance of the show, because we need to see how the Jews have manipulated our society. And here's an item quickly before I play any audio. The Jewish gift to humanity, the nuclear nightmare. Below is only a partial list. The total number of the Jews involved is staggering and shocking, and the list below is incomplete due to time restrictions. The list below contains the most noted Jewish scientists who worked directly on the Manhattan Project. And so the Jewish gift to humanity is nuclear explosions. J. Robert Oppenheimer, Frank Oppenheimer, his brother, Albert Einstein, Niels Bohr, Leo Szilard, Nicholas Kurti, David Bohm, Rudolf Pirls, Felix Bloch, Eugene Wigner, James Chadwick, James Frank, Otto Frisch, Edward Teller, Emilio Gino. Edward Teller is the one who developed the H-bomb. Emilio Gino Segre, Hans Albrecht Bethe, Klaus Fuchs, Morris Kolodny, Louis Rosen, Louis Slotin, Jacob Beeser, Theodore Alvin Hall, Samuel T. Cohen. And that's just half the list. So if you think that the Atom Bomb Project was an American institution, no, it's a Jewish institution. And it was created to destroy Nagasaki. And as Mr. Goodrich pointed out, the two cities that were bombed were the most Christian cities in Japan at the time, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Those two cities were chosen specifically by the Jews because they were the most Christian cities in Europe, in Japan. That's what we're dealing with when we're dealing with Jews, folks. You have no idea. You have no idea how evil these people are. How evil these people are. Okay, let's see if we can get one of these videos playing here. Okay. Had it lined up for today's show, but okay, let's see if we can find it here. Was George Patton murdered? Was George Patton murdered? There's no doubt that he was. This is from warfarehistorynetwork.com. Patton was frequently in hot water with the high command. In October 1940, Patton was promoted to Brigadier General and given command of the 2nd Armored Division at Fort Benning, Georgia. After the United States entered the war, Patton's troops waded ashore in North Africa in November 1942 during Operation Torch. His troops took Morocco and subsequently participated in the Allied invasion of Sicily in July 1943. Some aspects of Patton's conduct in Sicily got him into trouble with the Allied High Command. During the Messina operation, 73 Italian prisoners were killed by Allied soldiers of the 45th Division. Two men were, this is right out of the books we were just discussing. Two men were put on trial for the crimes. In their defense, the men said they carried out the attack because they were obeying orders from Patton, who had told his men in a June 27 speech that they should take no prisoners. To prevent a full-fledged scandal from breaking out, General Omar Bradley decided to drop all the charges against the two American soldiers. Patton also got into hot water in an incident that took place on August 3, 1943. While visiting the 15th Evacuation Hospital, Patton asked Private Charles Cool why he was in the hospital. Private Cool replied, "I guess I can't take it." Witnesses said the general slapped him with his glove and pulled him up forcibly by his collar. That's a very famous incident where he slapped the soldier around. But, you know, we see that other generals did this. I think the bad press gotten by George Patton is due to the fact that they didn't want him to become famous. Okay, here we go. Bill O'Reilly investigates. Here's one on the assassination. Patton assassination. Here we go.
Hey, guys. I'm here today with Tim Wilcox, who's the head of International Investigators in Indianapolis. He's an old friend of mine. He knows lots of stuff, a lot of interesting history, and his cousin wrote a book called Target Patton. Tim had a lot of hand in this thing, and I thought you guys would really enjoy hearing some of what Tim has to say about this, especially in as much as Bill O'Reilly has made the whole killing Patton thing popular now. Maybe you want a little bit of the real story. Tim, thank you very much for taking time with us at My Service Pride. Talk to me.
My cousin Bob has been a writer for many, many years. He's just a few years younger than me. And I just happened to be chatting with him one time about Patton being assassinated, because he's my cousin's a World War II history buff. His father was a decorated colonel in the war, and so he couldn't believe that Patton was assassinated. And so I said, well, I know the guy that did it, or was involved in the assassination. And Douglas Bezzotta, who we had hired before to do special ops for us. My company, okay. National Investigators, primarily to extract kids from other countries that were taken illegally from our country. And so I got to know him pretty well. And he was introduced to me by Nick Longworth, who's an old friend and was involved in Washington politics. Mm-hmm. And so we gave assignments to Douglas Bezzotta on several occasions. And I got to know him pretty well. And he was kind of intimating that he was involved in the assassination of the most famous general of World War II. And he'd actually taken some polygraph tests and he'd passed those. And so I said, maybe to my cousin, maybe you ought to interview this guy. He was probably 85 or 86 years old at that time. He was one tough dude. He was the Marine Corps heavyweight boxing champion from 1935 to 1941. He was assigned to the OSS in a special operation called the Jedburgh, which is like the Navy SEALs now. They dropped Bezzotta behind the German lines, and he was very successful. And then during the occupation, after the war was over in Europe, General Wild Bill Donovan was the head of the OSS. And sometime in the fall of 1945, he assigned a special operation to Bezzotta to kill Patton. We don't know exactly where the orders originated from, but probably the commander-in-chief, which is President Truman at that time.
Yeah. Why would Truman have wanted Patton killed?
Pressures from the Soviet Union, pressures from General Eisenhower.
Patton was wanting to invade.
Patton was, I guess you could call him, a little bit out of control. He was trying to marshal forces to invade the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Had he been successful, he would probably have eliminated the Cold War, and who knows what that would have saved his country.
Can you imagine?
So there was apparently two other unsuccessful attempts at killing Patton. One was sometime in the fall of 1945. He was driving in the back seat of his Jeep through some small town, and the bad guys knew about it, and so they were going to drop a cable down and garrote his head. And it was coming almost like Inspector Clouseau and the Pink Panther. He drops his cigar and reaches down, and just as the cable went by, so he survived that. And then there was another situation where he was in a reconnaissance plane, a Piper Cub, overlooking parts of Poland, and somebody got a hold of a Polish Spitfire and tried to shoot him down, and Patton's pilot was better and outmaneuvered it. So that was the second time.
And I read in here that that they observed four aircraft overhead as if that the other aircraft were doing reconnaissance for this operation below.
It was a major operation to kill him.
Yeah.
A lot of Bob's information came directly from Douglas Bezzotta, because he gave him two huge boxes of diaries and journals and documents and things like that.
That's amazing.
He went to the National Archives and tried to find the investigation and the report of the medical reports and all that. Everything disappeared from the National Archives. But what actually happened is the third attempt was going to be the day before he was going to leave for the U.S. to resign his commission. And he and General Gay went hunting in Germany the day before. And on the way back, there was a plot to kill him with a special air rifle that shot a mushroom-shaped projectile.
Was this Bezzotta's?
This was Bezzotta's operation.
He was laying in wait with this air rifle.
Yeah, and somebody had stolen a deuce and a half from a motor pool, and the deuce and a half ran into the front of a Patton's Cadillac limo, caused a minor accident. Patton was, at the precise time, was shot in the back of the head with this thing. It broke his neck, threw him forward to the glass partition between the front and the back seat. Had all kinds of lacerations on his head, and they thought he was dead, but he actually survived that. And General Gay, who was sitting in the back seat with him, didn't even have a bruise on his knees. So it was all contrived through Bezada's operation. They take him to past several hospitals, to another hospital in Heidelberg, and they put him in some kind of a special neck brace, and the neck brace was not working for him. His vital signs were diminishing. This all happened on December 11th, 1945. His vital signs were diminishing, and the next day the media was there, and there happened to be a British neurosurgeon that happened to be there. Looks at the x-rays, looks at the device on his head, and he says, that's the worst thing he can possibly do. Changed it around so it was more effective. In the next few days, his vital signs came back. And on December 19th, he had a press conference, and he announced to the media that he was going to go back to...
Patton had a press conference?
He was sitting up in bed drinking his bourbon and giving the nurses a hard time. And so he announced to the media at like 10 o'clock in the morning that he was going to go back to Walter Reed for final recovery and go back into...
Is there footage of that?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he was dead. No autopsy, no pathology, no toxicology. The medical reports disappeared from the National Archives. The investigation reports have all disappeared. And Bob is really chronicalized everything that happened in this book, and you draw your own conclusion. But the conclusion that you would have to draw just from logic is that Patton was assassinated.
Now, was the operation in the hospital Bezada's action, or was he done with
the Soviet NKVD had totally infiltrated the OSS.
Yeah.
So it was probably a Soviet-inspired assassination.
And the OSS was a precursor to the CIA.
Yes.
Fascinating. Well, guys, this is an amazing book. If you've read O'Reilly's, or if you have heard some of the noise and you want the real story, Robert K. Wilcox, Tim's cousin, Target Patton, you can get it on his website. You know,
I think it's robertkwilcox.com.
Yeah, or Google it, or you can get Amazon or whatever. It's awesome. It's really, really interesting. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks. Later.
My name is David Irving. You've probably read my books. That's probably why you've got this recording. I'm going to talk about my life and times and where I come from. The reason I'm making this recording is because way ahead now, I'm at an age when you can begin to see the stoplights ahead. Some, they're beginning to turn amber, and you don't know when they're going to turn red. I've got about 3 books left to write. I've got the third volume of my Churchill biography. I've got a Himmler biography I'm working on, which has taken 10 years already with some interruptions that I'm going to talk about. And I've got my own personal autobiography. So what you're hearing now is something of my own personal autobiography, where I come from, who I am, what I believe, and the books I've written, and the methods that have been used by the people I call the traditional enemies of free speech, the people who try to stop me from researching, from writing, from publishing what I find to be true, and then from distributing the books that I've published. It's been an interesting fight, and believe me, it's still going on. I was born the last son of a Royal Navy commander. He was a man who fought in the Battle of Jutland in 1916 as an ensign aboard a British battleship. And then in World War II, he fought again, finally being invalided out in 1942 after making several runs with the Royal Navy escorting the Arctic convoys from Iceland to North Russia. He was a great man. He was a wonderful writer, too, and I suppose perhaps something of his writing ability has percolated through into my veins as well. He wrote a book on the Battle of Jutland. He wrote another book on the First Battle of the Falkland Isles and of Coronel. He wrote the official history of the Royal Yacht, the King's Britannia, his book is called. And finally, the very last book he ever wrote was a book on the Battle of Jutland, which he and I wrote together because he was by that time a very old man. I say he was very old, but my brother told me a few weeks ago, he said, you know, David, Daddy died, and he's younger at a time when he was younger than either of us are now. That's something you don't really want to be told. It's a salutary warning that you've only got a limited span of life on this mortal coil, and you've got to put it to the best use you can. Unfortunately, my writing career has been interrupted once or twice. It's interrupted twice by prison. In 1995, a German publisher had me sent to prison for 2 weeks for contempt of court in England, in a famous prison where they used to hang people. They hanged Dr. Crippen in Pentonville Prison. And in 2005, I was ambushed in Austria when I went to lecture to university students, and I was put on trial in Austria under a law introduced by the Stalin government in 1945. A law called the Banning Law. The Banning Law. Under the Banning Law, I was accused of having written or said things that might have been more favorable to the Nazi government than would be politically correct. I was put on trial in February 2006 and sentenced to 3 years in prison. And I began serving that prison sentence in the oldest prison in Austria, in Vienna. And I stayed there for 400 days in solitary confinement, in a room about six feet square. Imagine sitting in a room six feet square, looking at the smallest room in your house, and I sat looking at those walls for the next 400 days, very little exercise, until finally the Austrian Court of Appeal, addressed by a very brave Austrian lawyer who himself had been repeatedly prosecuted and threatened for defending people who believed in free speech like me. The Austrian Court of Appeal ordered my immediate release, even then they held me in prison for another day, a different police prison, while the same judge tried to get a new charge up and running against me on the account that I had spoken to the BBC. I made an interview with the BBC from that prison block in Vienna in 2006. The BBC gave me a phone number to phone, and I saw that phone standing there in the prison wing. I picked up the phone and spoke for 10 minutes to the BBC. And the BBC broadcast that interview with me, a prisoner in Vienna, over the BBC networks around the world all day long. And on account of that, a new charge was levelled against me by the judge under Section 3H of the Banning Law. Under Section 3H of the Banning Law, I could have been sentenced to 20 years in prison, or even life, because of repeated offences. You see, some countries believe in free speech and some countries don't. I thought we won World War II against Germany and Austria too, of course. But apparently some of these old problems are creeping back in. Anyway, all that water under the bridge, I came out of prison on December 21st, 2006. I had great difficulty walking down the street, I couldn't step up on the sidewalk because that step was too painful, my muscles were not hot, they were turning to jelly. And here I am, a couple of years down the road, beginning to put my life back together again. For six months I lived in hotel rooms, tried to put my life back together again. All my possessions have been destroyed or lost. And I am back in this house here. Not far from the castle where the Queen lives in Windsor. Lovely old English country house. Surrounded by a beautiful country garden. And I've begun writing again. I look back over my writing career. My writing career began back in the 1960s. I left England at university. I'd been in English public school. In public school, I was an active young scholar. In fact, a short film showed me berating the crowd of students in the public school, Brentwood School. A piece of 60 millimeter film taken by one of our school teachers. And I managed to find that recently. I left from school in a few years. I tried to get a degree, not easy because of a very poor background. My father and my brother, my mother were not artists. She illustrated radio times and other magazines, and you can't bring up four children on that kind of payment. And when you get to university, you find that some students are much better off than you are. I tried 3 years to get a degree in physics, and changed eventually to learning politics and economics at University College. Between that time,
I went to Germany to work as a steel worker.
It's a strange choice, you may think, but having been deferred from the National Service.
I decided to volunteer for the Royal Air Force, like my brother. Rather than do a two-year service at the University of Cambridge, I decided to volunteer for the Royal Air Force to do a three-year short service course, a commission, like lieutenant, Cambridge University, studying Russian. The idea was to get a Russian, I suspect, what I found myself doing eventually, but having volunteered for the Air Force, I was turned down. I got no idea why, because I'd been politically active at London University on the right wing. And these things happened.
But the good news was that I had to serve about three or two years,
and I decided to be a steelworker in Germany instead.
I applied to Krauss,
the big giant steel firm that turned out the tanks in World War II. And Krauss turned me down. They sent back a rather smutty letter saying, due to the fact that the Allies destroyed our steelworks and dismantled everything we had, we don't have a job for you. So I applied then to Krauss's rival, the great Thyssen steel concern. Fritz Thyssen was one of the people who actually bankrolled Hitler in the 1930s. And Thyssen accepted me as an unskilled steelworker. I worked on steelwork on the furnace stage for many months in the loneliest period of my life, in fact.
You can't speak the language.
You lose confidence when you're in a foreign country and speak the language.
I had a vast level of knowledge. I had 13 master subjects, 17 gulags, so I had what you might consider to be a very wide shadow knowledge.
I knew a little about a lot of subjects, a lot of little things you usually come out of university.
When I was at Steelworks, the furniture in the room, I lived in a bachelor home, about 12 other steelworks, and we shared beds.
I think there were four beds, we were on a round-the-clock shift. The first time I ever worked on a shift plan again, I didn't want to have to be woken by an alarm clock again. That's one of the resolutions I made. One of the men who shared that room with me, he saw me one day reading a magazine about the World War, and the magazine had a series called The Lights Went Out Over Europe. It was about the bombing, there was a story there about the air raid on Germany in 1945 that killed 100,000 people in the British air. He said, I was there, David, I was in that city, it was Dresden. My blood runs cold even now when I think about 100,000 people being burned alive in my blood. I'd written an article for the Daily Telegraph, which they published a few weeks earlier, and I thought I'm going to write an article about this one too. And I sat down and began researching. By writing letters to people, and learning everything I could from that and other people what had happened in Dresden. When I left the steelworks, I began to write, but I realized this wasn't just an article, this was a book.
And I began advertising. In the German newspapers and in the Times of England, people had been in the air on the ground.
I advertised an American newspaper, American man, taking part in the raid in Dresden the following day. And eventually I filled a file with about 600 letters from people who had written to me. I went all around Germany. I did television programs, a bit of a freak. This was an Englishman who was going to write about the bombing war. In Germany, the subject was taboo. Nobody talked about it. So here's an Englishman who was breaking the taboo, and people sent letters to the TV stations, how could they tell me what they've been there to that grand Dresden? So I brought out this fantastic file of letters from people who had been in the air. Eventually I went and spoke to Marshal Royal Air Force Bomber Harris, a great commander. I know people don't like him. I know people call him a criminal, you've got to admit. The man who is capable of sending 30,000 of his 50,000 airmen to their deaths, which they did unflinchingly, must be a great commander. I think he deserves that statue that he now has outside St. Bride's Church in Peace Street. Bomber Harris told me he hadn't wanted to carry out a raid either, that he'd been ordered, it was a political decision by Churchill himself. I remember interviewing him back in April 1962. Great man. And I interviewed his deputy as well, so on. And the book that was finally published. became a bestseller. I should explain when that advert appeared in the Times personal column, British Water is seeking people who work in the area. I received a letter not just from the Airwind or the survivors, but from a publisher, William Kimber. Kimber said, David, if you're looking for a publisher, I will publish the book for you. I've always felt very strongly about that particular client. And so suddenly I crossed the first threshold, which I didn't know turns out to be the worst, most difficult threshold for any author, finding a publisher. He approached me, he came to me, he was my publisher for the next three or four books. What we call an English gentleman publisher. A lovely man, many guys telegraphed, asked me to write an obituary for him, which I did, part of the obituary. He was such a gentleman, he never told me that authors get advances. I don't know if he really begrudged it. He published the book, which had just begun his life, and the Sunday paper, 1963. The editor of the Sunday Telegraph, the one who had just begun his life, and the Sunday paper, 1963. The editor of the Sunday Telegraph, the middle-labelled intelligence in the famous submarine tracking during World War II. He knew what he was talking about. He was personally interested in me. He published my next three books, The Serials, and the Sunday Telegraph. You wouldn't believe that, now, of course, if you read what the English newspapers write about me. My articles have been published in the Sunday Telegraph, the Sunday Express, the Sunday Telegraph, the Sunday Times, the Sunday Paper, published series of articles by David Irving, but now of course I am hated and despised because I am what they call a Holocaust denier. I'm not.
But this is what they called me then. At that time I was an enfant gâté.
I was a chosen child, as they say. The money was showered on me. I found an American agent, Beth Becker, who became, I suppose, my principal source of income for the next 20 years. He died in 1992, and with his death, this was the first, well, not the nail in my coffin, but it was a hammer blow to me. Max Becker contacted me and he said, David, I didn't want an agent, I would say. Why should I get an agent 10%? For doing nothing, I'm writing the book, he's just got a sold book for it, why should he get 10%? Some of them get 15%. He telephoned me a few days after I hired him, he said, David, the American publishing house, Little Brown, they're going to buy your book called Field Marshal Milchow and Gurion Deputy, and they want $30,000 for it. That was in 1967. Now, $30,000 is a big sum of money.
I remember, encouraged by that, I turned to my wife, we had four children by then, and I said, we're going to move out of Paddington. She said, where are we going to move to?
I said, we have a choice. Either we can move out in the country and have a country house to live in, or we can move into the center. And she looked for a while, couldn't find somewhere to live. I said, I can find somewhere in 2 hours, I guarantee.
I drove down to Gloucester Road, went to the estate agents, Marla and Marla. And they looked out and they said, well, terribly sorry, we're looking for a six-room apartment. Very difficult to find a six-room apartment down there. Nobody wants an eight-room apartment in Mayfair, just off Grosvenor Square.
And I said, how much would it be? And they said, well, £1,000 a year. £1,000 a year? I can't possibly afford that. But we'll do it. So within 2 hours, I found an apartment in Grosvenor Square.
In Duke Street, just between Grosvenor Square and Selfridges.
It's an eight-room apartment on the first floor, the American called the second floor.
And I lived there for the next 38 years.
I bought the apartment eventually. Everything I owned was seized in the year 2002, let me just say that straight away. By then it was worth over £1 million. It was all taken away from me, my possessions, everything, my archives, my library, my papers, everything I owned was seized in 2002. So for 38 years I lived in that apartment. Very happily, raised the family, swore them off, wrote the books,
which I'm going to be talking about now.
When I was writing the book on Dresden, I went behind the iron curtain two or three times. In those days, Dresden was in the Soviet zone of Germany. I wanted to speak to the people there and treat them as something of a celebrity because they'd never seen it before. Somebody writing the history of their own tragedy. Every year in Dresden they had an annual ceremony of people coming from all over the city carrying candles and placing them on the ruins of the cathedral in the center of the city. And I found a man there called Fritz Hahn. Fritz Hahn was a publisher during World War II. He was one of the special people dedicated to the world.
Listen to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Take a look around, kid. What do you see? Homes being foreclosed. People working 2-3 jobs just to put food on the table and still drowning in debt. Don't get me wrong. This country was founded on great ideals and principles. They've all been ruined by the banks. Open your eyes to the banks that are robbing you. You know who my favorite president was?
Who?
Thomas Jefferson. Because he saw all of this coming and tried to stop it. He fought the banks. JFK too, and they killed him for it. The banking institution is more dangerous than an army, he said. He also said that every generation needs a revolution, Jimmy. The American dream is just that. Just a dream. War is a continuation of politics, only by other means. Politics is a continuation of economics by other means. This is our bank. This is our war. And this is our plan of attack.
Banks have become an essential threat to our democracy. So consider this justice.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution. Radio!
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Join me weekdays for my new show, Tell Chris Joe. It's going to be a problem show brought to you live from Kensington. Thursdays, I'm dealing with hot topics, heated debate, what's new around the world, and ring-ins to discuss listeners' problems and offering considered and heartfelt solutions. So join me, Chris Hart, for Tell Chris Joe. Stop what you're doing, grab a cup of tea, I'm coming live from Kensington. Relax. Let me entertain you with a coffee bar online. Listeners, very personal problems. So that's Thursdays, 2 p.m. in the afternoon, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. See you there. It's going to be lots of fun.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and freedomslips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, Freedom Slips.